Here's a traditional radio telescope. Radiation is collected onto a feed. The electric field of the feed is the sum of reflections off of different surface elements. And when the telescope is in focus, the path lengths are the same, and we get constructive interference. For a source that was off the focus, the paths would not interfere constructively, but that's why telescope focuses. The idea of an interferometer is to mimic the combination of delays achieved by a dish in software. So you get rid of the dish and just collect and digitize the electric field at a plane, at a plane of locations, and then combine these, add the digitized signals together with the correct delays to simulate the dish pointing in a particular direction. You can repoint the telescope by using a different set of delays. The advantage of doing this is the digital signals can be copied. So if you have enough computational power, you can do this calculation in parallel for a variety of different directions, for n different directions, and have the same statistical power as n telescopes observing in parallel in slightly different directions. Of course, the computational cost is higher by a factor of n. So this is CHIME. It's a telescope that we're building now in Penticton, BC. It's the first major research Canadian research telescope in many years. We have a 4 by 256 array of antennas. Each of these cylindrical telescopes has 256 antennas. We have enough computing power to form all 1,024 independent beams. So this is kind of an amazing claim, but it is true that the raw sensitivity of this instrument is the same as 1,024 telescopes with the same collecting area. That would be like roughly the collecting area of a big research telescope like DBT. 1,024 copies, all pointing in slightly different directions, observing 24/7.
Stupid question, but why the 256 antennas? Where's the 256 SC4?
Each of these telescopes has an array has 256 antennas hanging under. Yeah, you can't see it on the plot, but hanging under the speed line.
Each one is single.
There are 256 little dipole antennas hanging off the feed line. So just to introduce some terminology I'm going to use in the talk. So the CHIME design is a compromise between optical focusing and interferometric software focusing. So a single feed would see this beam on the sky. The cylinder focuses in the east-west direction, but not the north-south direction. And each of the feeds see the same so-called primary beam. That's the term for the beam seen by a single feed. And by taking interferometric combinations, we can form an array of 4 by 256 software beams. We can form those beams anywhere, but only within the primary beam, of course. Primary beam is fixed in telescope coordinates if the instrument has no moving parts. But as the sky rotates, it sweeps over the sky. So every 24 hours, the output of CHIME is a sky map with angular resolution around 20 arc minutes, covering half the sky. And the frequency range of the instrument, I should say, is 400 to 800 megahertz. That frequency range was chosen because if you want to observe neutral hydrogen, cosmological neutral hydrogen via the 21 centimeter line, it gives this redshift range, which is sort of the so-called redshift desert, where the optical galaxies are running out, but the Lyman Alpha forest hasn't started yet. From everything that I've said so far, you would deduce that the statistical power of a radio telescope is roughly proportional to its mapping speed, which is defined to be the collecting area times the number of independent beams that can be formed. Times some order one factors that I've omitted for this order of for this back of the envelope slide, things like reflection efficiencies, system temperatures, bandwidths, etc. And here are some famous radio telescopes compared. And I'm showing you the table, the comparison that got me interested in the project a couple of years ago. So as you can see, CHIME is, this is a back of the envelope calculation, so all you can say is that CHIME is comparable to or better than everything on the list. By this metric, it's the most powerful radio telescope in the world, including FAST. If you think about what this is saying, here are FAST and CHIME compared to scale. FAST is a 500 meter telescope in China. It's like a roughly $1 billion project. It's one of the biggest and most expensive projects in science. And CHIME is this little thing, well, by comparison, that we're throwing together in British Columbia for 1% of the budget. Could it really be true that these instruments have the same statistical power? It seems too good to be true, but it also seems too simple to be wrong.
But didn't you say that's better? Time is better than faster?
Well, I mean, I didn't actually put in all the order one factors here, so I don't think you can really conclude that. So there's a catch. That indeed it is true in this comparison that the right column, the mapping speed, determines the statistical power of the instrument in principle given infinite computational power. But time gets that high mapping speed from a huge number of beams with low per beam sensitivity. So that if you're trying to compute something, then the computational cost is given by this column. It'll be proportional to the number of beams, or maybe worse, depending on what you're doing. So what we're really doing here is we're not getting something for nothing. We're pursuing a strategy of, instead of facing the hardware challenge and fundraising challenge of building a monster telescope, to build a small instrument with many feeds and confront hard problems in software instead. And radio astronomy has a reputation for being extremely computationally intensive. We need supercomputers to analyze data sets. So you might wonder whether this is a step in the right direction. We've sort of increased by a factor of 50. The only way to find out is to try to do the experiment. That's what we're doing, and that's what I'm going to talk about. I'll say a little bit about the Chime hardware. So the telescopes are cabled to some shipping containers full of FPGAs and GPUs, graphic processing units. And this farm of special hardware is what's called the correlator. What it computes is every interesting two-point correlation function between different antennas in the array. And that can tell you, you can extract from that data product that's being continuously computed in real time. And if there's something you want to know about the sky, like what's the linear polarization of the sky in this direction, then you can ask the correlator for that data product over the network. So we build backends. These are each independent computing clusters that ask the correlator for different things. The scale of the computation here is huge. The total bandwidth in these links is 7 terabits per second, which is a few percent of the global internet routed between shipping containers in a valley in BC, which is kind of crazy. This correlator is, I don't know for sure, but I think it may be the number three, the third most powerful supercomputer in Canada, certainly in the top five. So depending on what you're doing, you might ask the correlator for something different. For example, we have a pulsar timing backend. If you were trying to time known pulsars to nanosecond precision, then what you would want to know is, for a certain software-defined set of locations on the sky, what is the electric field at the full-time resolution of the instrument, nanosecond sampling? And so the pulsar backend receives those time streams. The pulsar backend is sort of like a little observatory where we have 10 GBTs that can point instantaneously at different, at arbitrary software-defined locations. Another backend I'll talk about a lot is the FRB backend. We're looking for fast radio bursts. So that receives more beams compared to the pulsar timing backend, but less information per beam. It only receives intensities, which are the squared electric field averaged over polarizations, and also downsampled from nanosecond cadence to millisecond cadence.
You don't use more beams in the pulsar timing because you don't do better?
This was roughly given by, we were interested in timing known pulsars to contribute timing data to projects like Nanograph. Mm-hmm. And if you work out how many interesting pulsars are in the Chime primary beam at one time, 10 is about the right number. Even with 10, it's still like fairly, the expense is sort of non-trivial in terms of network bandwidth and computing power. I like this slide just as a way of illustrating the scale of the computational problems. If you think about the FRB backend, the number of numbers it receives per second over the network works out to a number around 10 to the 10. And to put that number in perspective, suppose you just wanted to simulate the input to the FRB backend to test whether it was working. That's something we like to do. Just simulating Gaussian random numbers at this level would require a dedicated 400-core computer. So you can imagine that if we want to do anything interesting with this time stream, that's going to be more expensive than just simulating random noise. So we're in for some tough computational problems. So the question I was asking before, is it true that a telescope like FAST and a telescope like Chime are equivalent? The answer is no. That's too simple, too simplistic. But maybe it was true. I was thinking a couple of years ago that Fast is equivalent to chime plus a lot of new math and algorithms ideas for some categories of problems, but maybe not others. So here are the things I'm going to talk about. The answer, of course, depends on what question you're asking. When talking about these topics can be really technical, so I have to make a choice between breadth and depth. And so what I'm going to do is start out talking about things in more technical detail. I'm going to talk about the fast radio bursts in like merciless technical detail. And then I'll just sort of get more and more big picture as the talk goes on.
Kenneth, do you want to use the pointer?
No, it's all right. I kind of like this. I kind of like hand waving.
You can use a stick if you want.
I kind of like that. I don't know. Unless it's distracting to you guys.
It's pretty well.
Hand waving talk.
Okay, so fast radio bursts are a recent mystery in astrophysics. We're gathering information, but we don't know what they are. So occasionally, a bright, narrow, highly dispersed radio pulse is observed. And dispersed means that the arrival time of the pulse depends on the frequency channel where it's observed, with a delay that's proportional to frequency to the minus 2. That exponent is what you get from dispersion of a cloud of electrons between the pulse and the observer, assuming that the assumptions are that the cloud is cold, unmagnetized, and optically thin. So when you measure the dispersion, you get to measure one number, the line of sight integral of the electron density. The high observed dispersion measure suggests enough electrons to plausibly put the burst at cosmological distances. There's a very important result. Not ours, but I'll mention it. One FRB, the so-called repeating FRB, which is special, it repeats unlike the others, despite a lot of time spending looking for other repeaters. This was shown to be cosmological, which was something that was an open question, whether these were really at cosmological distances. At redshift point
two.
Oh, yeah, so the repeater, you know where it is, so you can just have telescopes stare. And if you have a big VLBI, very long baseline interferometer stare, then eventually you see it and you can get milli-arcsecond or micro-arcsecond resolution, which is enough to pin it down to a galaxy and then follow up and get a redshift. If you forecast the in-principle sensitivity of chime to FRBs, you get a number like 10 events per day, which is pretty incredible considering that there are 20 known so far. The search problem that you have to solve looking for these dispersed, a blind search for these dispersed pulses is very computationally challenging. So there are lots of papers on this topic and public software, but it's not even close to being fast enough to get this event rate, search all the data and get this event rate. Over the last year or so, we've developed a search algorithm which is much faster and can actually search the whole chime data set pretty optimally and get this event rate. We're building a computing cluster on site that should go online in June. I'll tell you about our algorithm. It will probably be either a 1200 core cluster or 2400 core cluster.
And do you have the power there?
Oh, yeah, yeah. The correlator is like 300 kilowatts. This cluster would be small compared to the correlator. But the power bill for chime is a non-trivial issue. The problem can be set up as follows. For each of 1,024 beams, the FRB backend is receiving a 2D array incrementally in time chunks. And what we want to look for is a dispersed pulse that cuts through with a new to the minus 2 delay. We want to search for all pulses of that type. The first step is just to make this change of variables, frequency to frequency of the minus 2, to make the dispersion tracks look like straight line. Then the brute force algorithm would just be to loop over every possible dispersion delay and then sum along the straight lines. But here's something that is much faster. It is a tree algorithm that ends up approximating each of these straight line tracks by a jagged sum. That jagged sum is computed recursively. If you imagine starting with, here's an example with 8 frequency channels. If you imagine forming all possible sums, where a sum can be formed in 2 ways, there's a blue sum, which is vertical, and a red sum, which is diagonal, the blue sums, put all the blue sums in one child array and all the red sums in another child array. The color coding is supposed to indicate how the each array, individual array element in the leaves corresponds to a sum of two elements in the parent. And then you just repeat this procedure recursively. If I take each of these child arrays and form all vertical and like one step diagonal sums, then I get, I now have four leaves in the tree. And the color coding shows how a particular element in a leaf, say this one, it corresponds to a sum of two elements in the parent, and that goes back to being a sum of four elements in the root. When you get to the bottom, you've built up a bunch of diagonal sums, which approximate the straight line tracks that you want to compute. And the point of this is that it's sort of reusing intermediate products in the calculation to speed it up. The computational cost is proportional to TD log D, where D is the number of dispersion channels and T is the number of time samples, whereas just a brute force loop summing over every diagonal track would be TD squared. So this is a big speed up. This is like the amount that the FFT speeds up the brute force Fourier transform.
Can I ask, so why did it just do FFT?
I don't think this is obvious, but there is a way to factor this so-called dedispersion transform as a sequence of FFTs. And it has the same asymptotic complexity, but this tree approach turns out to be faster by an order one amount. That was actually by like an order one factor. It's significantly faster. That was actually the first thing that I tried, but I didn't put it in the talk. Okay. Tree algorithms have been studied in the literature, and there seem to be claims that they are not close to optimal if you are using a wide bandwidth, that these jagged tracks don't sufficiently approximate a true straight line. So one thing we figured out, there are a lot of hidden choices in this algorithm, like how you weight the channels when you initially assign them to the array, whether you upsample the tree relative to the data, and so on. And so one thing that we showed how to do is if you make these hidden choices appropriately for a certain set of hidden choices, you can make the tree arbitrarily close to optimal. So those claim disadvantages we think are not an issue. Our initial implementation of this was very fast, but still not quite fast enough for time. It's just too big of a data set. So we went really far down the rabbit hole of physicists pretending to be computer scientists. And so I'll just show a few slides, which will probably mainly be of interest if you're some sort of hardcore computer nerd. I know there are a few hardcore computer nerds in the audience. But I feel morally obligated to include them because these reflect how I actually spend like 80% of my time. So first off, the tree algorithm can be blocked. What blocked means is the following. The way that I presented the algorithm, the entire array has to be exchanged between main memory and the processor's L3 cache in each iteration of the tree. And this creates a big memory bandwidth bottleneck when you have data going back and forth. So many algorithms, like linear algebra algorithms, use an approach where you block the algorithm. So it is not obvious, but it is true. And I think it's not too hard to find if you know what you're supposed to be looking for. That this algorithm can be organized in such a way that it runs on small chunks of the input array. There's some cache local operation that then goes out to main memory. And then on the other end, you have small blocks being extracted to feed the output array. So that it is possible to make a mathematically equivalent alternate implementation of this algorithm that only exchanges memory data between memory and cache once. That's the big speed up. And a nice side effect of this blocking is our algorithm is the only dedispersion algorithm I know of that can do low latency real-time alerts. So because we process in little chunks, we can detect an FRB within a short chunk size of the radiation entering the telescope. So we think we could send out alerts within a few seconds of the trailing edge of the FRB entering the telescope. There are lots of low-level optimizations that I'll just put up here. I did at one point read the entire 700-page Intel x86 optimization manual, and I learned about all of this black magic stuff you can do if you are interested in memory bandwidth bottlenecks, for example. At the end of the day, our implementation is a factor 7 faster than a C implementation of tree D dispersion, which I originally believed at the beginning of the project to be highly optimized. And this factor of 7 really matters for bringing the computation within reach for Chime. There was a period where we thought that we couldn't necessarily search all of the data. And then there was a period where we thought we could search all of our data, but the back end would cost something like $2 million. And now the budget, just for the nodes, other stuff like the network is not included, the budget for just the nodes is more like $300,000, the factor of 7. We would like the whole community to get this factor of 7. So we plan to release public code soon. One of the fun things about this project is that it feels like working on the CMB must have been like 30 years ago. The instruments have suddenly just gotten much better. There's a lot more science within reach. And now is sort of the time to build like fundamental tools that the community can use as larger instruments of Chime type hopefully get built. So we're tying up a lot of software loose ends. I think the most difficult algorithmic problems have been solved, but there's a lot of like engineering work left to do for sure. And over the summer, if we stay on schedule, we should start finding FRBs at this rate. And we hope that having much more statistics will help solve the mystery of what they are.
What do you see this public code being useful outside Chime,
DSKA,
or?
There are lots of experiments that do this type of search. The SKA is one example. There's also another project, a South African project, Hyrax, which is really similar to Chime.
But I was wondering, so you went very deep into things that are highly configured for what Chime's computer backend is.
I think that this would be fairly transferable to other projects. There's nothing about this problem that is the details of how this 2D array is constructed are very specific to Chime. But once you end up with this array that you're searching for pulses, it's pretty generic.
Is the 10 per day number for the Chime Pathfinder or full Chime?
Full Chime.
Is that also on Skylet's one?
Yeah.
Oh,
wow. If you're wondering whether fast is equivalent to Chime for FRBs, I think the answer is yes. We have totally crushed the FRB search problem. Let's next time I'll talk about a harder problem, looking for pulsars. So pulsar science has always been a very fertile and interesting area of astronomy. Of course, the first evidence for gravitational waves came from pulsars. The first detection of extrasolar planets also came from pulsar timing. Exceptionally precise tests of GR, pulsars are very accurate clocks. New astrophysics, obviously, we didn't necessarily expect, like magnetars. And lots of interesting sort of one-off systems. People write PhD theses trying to understand timing models of specific pulsars. Only a few percent of the predicted galactic population has actually been found. So there are statistically speaking, this subject is probably in its infancy, and there are more discoveries to be made. Here are some milestones that we'd like to achieve. Gravity waves from pulsars, the way that LIGO does by comparing timings, would be, of course, exceptionally interesting. A pulsar black hole binary is an example of an astrophysically interesting system that hasn't been found yet. Finding a new pulsar is kind of like a physics lottery ticket. You might find kind of a boring one, like just an isolated pulsar that's not doing anything interesting, or you might find like an exceptionally interesting one. Now, one of the coolest things that you could do with Chime, I think, is to find, a huge catalog of new pulsars. This plot, I don't have an actual number, a forecasted number, but this plot just compares the sensitivity floor of Chime to known discovered pulsars in the Northern Hemisphere. The point of the plot is that we can sort of add, if we could search our data to its full statistical power, we could add some order one, fraction of new pulsars. That would be a really amazing thing to do. But the Chime-sized data set, because the sensitivity is so distributed and it's also discontinuous in time, is really an unsolved problem. Existing pulsar search algorithms really can't handle the Chime data.
Can you show that plot? Can you compare the sensitivity of existing telescopes compared to Chime?
Oh, yeah, right.
Just to tell whether this fall off as you go to low flux sensitivity is due to the sensitivity.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's that is absolutely true.
I see.
But this represents the like the sensitivity floor, not.
Arecibo would be roughly there.
Arecibo would be. Most pulsars are found either with GBT or parks. Not a huge fraction of the sky has been surveyed with Arecibo, so Arecibo may be a little bit better, although I still think we would beat Arecibo.
So these current numbers, what's the estimate of the horizon distance that you giant would see a pulsar?
I don't know that number offhand.
Sorry, what distance?
How far would giant see a pulsar?
How far?
That would be a good number to compute, but I don't know.
You are saying China will see all of these.
It definitely has the sensitivity to. The question is, for a known pulsar, it would be no problem because you know the timing model and you can fold the data on the timing model and you would get, 50 sigma or something. You could test the sensitivity of time that way. But finding new pulsars is very tough. Yes?
So one other pulsar machine that's about to start up would be the Phase ALMA. That's going to become available in the next couple of years. ALMA has been phased into a single aperture, so you just take all the dishes in ALMA, glue them together. That's roughly the size of an ALMA dish with that on the back end.
Oh, cool.
I'm not sure where that's on this plot, but I think it's orders of magnitude more sensitive than Arecibo.
It might be, but it's going to have a really tiny beam, right? Like, that's more for...
No, phase yeah. ALMA. In fact, it's a much bigger beam. So, so you take the light of all the dishes and you add it in phase. And so you're not running it as an interferometer anymore. Okay, so it has the collecting area and it has the sensitivity of ALMA times 60. I was kind of interested what the comparison would be with that, because I know that's something that we're keen on, punching for pulsars in the galactic center with. The other one would be the looking to the future, how about the SKA? Where would the SKA be on this
picture? The SKA would, I don't know the answer to that. SKA 1 mid is probably back of the envelope, comparable to Chime. So I'm gonna tell you about, I've been thinking about this problem. I wrote this paper recently that I'm gonna tell you about in the next few slides. I think we've made a lot of progress in the case of a long contiguous time stream, which is actually a case, the emphasis being on the word long, where the existing algorithms do have a lot of trouble. The Chime case of a huge number of discontiguous time streams, I haven't really had a chance to think about yet. This is an extension that we plan to study yet. But one step at a time, I'll just give you a status update on what we've done so far.
It's discontiguous simply because it's rotating.
We see every spot in the sky for like 10 minutes every day.
Yeah.
Then we try to, and then when we stack those 10-minute observations, we have a ton of in-principle sensitivity. So pulsar would show up in the data as the FRB I showed before was one of these dispersed pulses. A pulsar would show up as a regular sequence. If the dispersion measure or the dispersion delay time of the pulsar were known a priori, then you would de-disperse the 2D array at that dispersion to get a 1D time series. All the pulsar search algorithms start with a big outer loop over trial dispersion delays and trial sky locations. In the rest of the slides, I'll talk about the problem as if it was just searching a single 1D time stream. Of course, this outer loop is very important when thinking about the total computational cost. So now what you want to do is loop over all phase models. The phase model I define as a periodic, a dimensionless function of time, so that pulses appear when the quantity phi is an integer multiple of 2 pi. For example, for a perfectly periodic pulsar with no speeding up or slowing down of the pulses, this function would be a straight line. Another thing that happens, there are lots of phases. The reason this is so expensive is that such a difficult problem is that there are so many phase models you want to search over. Another thing that happens is that pulsars decelerate. Their frequency slows down with time, say, as they lose energy. All these plots are exaggerated just to make nice plots. You might have a term proportional to t squared in the phase model. A binary pulsar would wiggle around a linear evolution as a Doppler shifts away from you or towards you.
So
I think it's useful to start by talking about what you would do if you had infinite computational power. Then what you would do is you would choose a phase model with some parameters, and you would loop over all possible values of those parameters. And for each phase model phi, you would compute this integral. You would integrate in time the data times the intensity time stream of the phase model, the sequence of pulses that I showed before. If the data contained a weak pulsar at that exact phase model, then it would pop out and you would get a large value of e hat. So the computational cost of computing this quantity e hat, I'm going to use this e hat notation a lot. It always means the integral of the data times a model. Is naively the size of the search space times the size of the time stream, the factor of s for the loop over phase models, and the factor of t for the, doing the integral. When I started thinking about this problem, I started with just the simple case of a linearly evolving phase model, where you have the phase model of the pulsar is a frequency and a periodic phase. So then you can think about this e hat as some sort of transform. E hat, in this case, is a function of omega and phi naught. And so you can think of e hat evaluation as being like an integral transform that takes a 1D function d and returns a function of two variables, e hat as a function of omega and phi naught. Result number one in the paper is that if you write down this transform, and it's a new result, which is surprising, but I don't think it's actually that hard to get if you have the idea to look for this. So if you just write down e hat as an integral and then play with that integral, you can factor the transform as a sequence of Fourier transforms, FFTs, and other facet operations like changing variables, regridding an array by interpolation. And so that speeds things up a lot. The optimal search statistic, this coherent search statistic e hat, can be evaluated much faster. I was sort of encouraged by this because in this simple search space, the optimal search can be done very quickly. That's actually new. What is currently done is something different that I didn't include a slide on, something called power spectrum folding, which throws away a lot of phase information and is not optimal. So it's very interesting that even in this simple case, there's something interesting to say.
What is S?
S is the number, I always use S in a particular search space to mean the number of independent search models in the space. So this would be you would have to grid the trial values of omega and the trial values of phi naught, and S would be the product of the number of grid points. So the next most complicated example would be the constant acceleration search, where you put a slow spin down of the pulsar alpha in. Here what seems to work really well, this is, let's say, result number two in the paper, is a tree algorithm, sort of inspired by the FRB search. What I do is I chunk the time stream, then there's a way of merging chunks. So if you've computed e hat in two chunks of length t, then you can merge those pre-computed them on grids, then you could merge those computations into a gridded table of e hat values on a time series of length 2t. It's not hard to see that the number of trial frequencies that are needed to enumerate every independent pulse model, the number of trial frequencies n omega scales as 1 power of t, and the number of trial accelerations scales as 2 power of t, 2 powers of t. As the tree search iterates, number of alphas is increasing faster than the number of omegas. You just start with a small enough chunk size that you don't need any trial alphas at all. And then you use the algorithm for the previous slide, the constant frequency case. So this is sort of a way of bootstrapping the algorithm from the previous slide, the case of a coherent search for a constant frequency pulsar into more complicated search spaces.
The periods usually change very, very slowly for pulsars. Does it really matter for discovery?
Absolutely. Yeah. This is sort of like the most mainstream, like default search that is done, this constant acceleration.
So if you don't put alpha, then you say you miss them?
The case really where you see this parameter is the case of a binary pulsar. Where if you had a long time stream and you saw a whole orbit, this model of course is not a good fit. But if you just see a small piece of the time stream, then you're Taylor expanding a sign, and it looks like p squared.
Isn't So is that a bigger, I realize pulsar spin downs are pretty slow for most cases, unless things were very exciting. But does that start to become a problematic assumption when you have the very top long time baseline data that I think you're talking about stacking, right? We normally would stare at a point on the sky for a night, and so the pulsar spins down however much it's been over it, a night. Whereas you're stacking many low signal noise ratio observations over months or years.
Oh yeah, we absolutely would see the intrinsic spin down of the pulsar, not just the orbital binary part in time over years. I mean, absolutely.
Do you have to include higher order terms in that, or I guess we're in the next case, so maybe I should shut up.
I have, to be honest, I actually haven't in this paper. I haven't actually really thought that much about the chime case. I was mostly imagining sort of like a 10-hour observation, like what GBD does for globular clusters. That was a case I wanted to think about first. Okay, so with that tree merging trick, the computational cost is the size of the search space is growing rapidly towards the top of the tree. The computational cost is a geometric series that converges, and so the computational cost is just dominated by the final merge and is order S, where S is just the number of search models where you evaluate E hat. That is a big improvement over the SD that you would get by brute force. And it is also the best possible computational speed for a coherent search, where by definition, when I say coherent search, I mean that I compute something for every point in the search space. So I sort of felt like I had found like the optimal algorithm, and I was wondering whether it was good enough for chime. And the answer is not even close. So I didn't put in this plot yet, which shows the reason why pulsar search is so hard is that if you want to analyze long time streams, the size of the search space tends to just really blow up as a function. S tends to really blow up as a function of t. If you consider, for example, modeling phi of t by Taylor series so that you include more and more terms as the time stream gets longer, then at first you just need 1 power of t for the number of trial frequencies. Then when you put in this term, the number of trial alphas grows as 2 powers of t, so the total is up to t cubed, then t to the 6th, then t to the 10th. And you just sort of hit this wall where even if your algorithm is order s, s is just a massive number. Like in chime, the s turns out to be something on the order of 10 to the 30. That's the number of, if you want the number of like bits of information that you need to write down a pulse model for chime.
Couldn't you just segment it into short periods and do your simple search in the short periods?
My intuition is that there is something kind of fake about this astronomical estimate of the computational cost, where I'm saying that if I just divide my data into 1% pieces, then I can do the super optimal search very quickly. But then when I try to put the pieces together, I have to sum over a number of of combinatorial possibilities equal to the lifetime of the universe. That just doesn't seem right. So a very natural idea is to find some scheme for stitching together doing the coherent search in chunks and finding some way of stitching things together. But a good way of doing that, I think, is an unsolved problem. And I have my scheme, what I'm going to talk about next. It may not be the only way of doing it, but here's the way that I like to do it. So I want to talk about an idea called semi-coherent search. Here's how it works. First, you define some space of jagged phase models. So as a concrete example, the idea is more general than the specific example, but just as a concrete example, suppose that you chunk the data, and then I consider all phase models phi of t, where such that I allow phi double dot to change to jump by either plus epsilon or minus epsilon at a chunk boundary. So phi double dot jumps, but phi dot and phi are given by integrating phi double dot, so those are evolved continuous. So I start with some initial conditions, and then I make 2 to the n choice or n binary choices to get a jagged phase model. If you choose parameters correctly, chunk sizes and epsilon and so on, then an arbitrary complicated phase model like a binary pulsar can be approximated well by a jagged one. Now I want to define a statistic h hat as follows. So h hat will be a function of some trial parameters, a trial phase, frequency, and acceleration in the initial conditions at time zero. And what I do is I sum over all 2 to the n jagged chunks that begin at that with those initial conditions. The quantity that I sum is e to the r e hat. E hat, remember, means that you take a phase model, you compute the pulsar intensity time stream for that phase model, and integrate it against the data. In the paper, I motivate this particular function, e to the r e hat, as opposed to some other nonlinear function of e hat.
Then you need an r parameter there, which is the weight of your chunk.
That's right. That is sort of an input parameter to the algorithm. So h hat is a sum of 2 to the n terms of the form e to the r e hat. That sum has exponentially many terms, which is bad if you're trying to make things run fast. It can be. It's not too hard to see that it is computable in linear time using recursion relations. So I actually thought the equations were clearer here than trying to draw a picture. Maybe the clearest thing is just to talk through the slide. So for a given set of initial data, I compute h hat by summing over all 2 to the n jagged paths that begin at those initial conditions. And the path is determined for the first chunk, and then I make my first binary choice. So what I do is I just split the sum with 2 to the n terms into two pieces with 2 to the n-1 terms. And then each of those pieces will be h hat defined, another value of h hat defined at this time. So you can iteratively compute backwards. If you suppose that I have h hat pre-computed for all initial conditions on this time slice, then I can step back to the previous time slice order in constant time. So I just start from the end and recurse backwards and build up tables of h hat values one time slice at a time. So this h hat search is fully coherent within a chunk, but on longer time scales, it's kind of summing over all ways of connecting the coherent chunks in a consistent way. This solves the problem of the computational cost being like a very steep function. You just chunk the data in whatever chunk size you can afford to do a coherent search. Then the scaling is linear in the time stream size after that. So the key question is how suboptimal is the search as the time stream gets large compared to the chunk size? And the answer in the paper is it's surprisingly close to optimal. For example, if you choose parameters carefully, there's some tricks. For 64 chunks, the search is only 20% suboptimal. So you can get a nearly optimal search doing a coherence with the computational cost of a coherent search that was 65 times smaller. That is actually a big deal. So for example, for time streams which are too long to search coherently, which is often the case, there's interesting public data where this is the case, you can do a coherent search for as long as you can afford to compute, and then use this chunking scheme to search much farther forward in time, search much deeper, and we should find lots of new pulsars this way. I think we really can, in public data, find lots of new pulsars. Another case which is interesting are time streams where you can search coherently, but it requires a supercomputer. Then you can go the other way. You can chunk the data set just for the sake of reducing computational cost. Reducing the chunk size by a factor of 64 because of this steep dependence results in a big improvement in the computational cost, like a factor of 1,000. So this could be a way to speed up cases where we can search well by a factor of 1,000 or so, which would be a big deal for something like this. Yeah.
Is this connected to what LIGO would be doing?
Yes. So LIGO, in the gravity wave community, I found the morning that I was posting the paper, I found that there is a gravity wave literature that uses the name semi-coherent search and solves it a similar problem, but the details are very different. So I think it would be very interesting to compare. I think my scheme makes a little more sense, but probably everyone who invents something thinks the same thing. So it would be very interesting to compare what I'm doing here to what LIGO is doing and see which one is better in that context. I think that would be a super interesting thing to do, but I just haven't had a chance.
Looking for in LIGO? Specific
waveforms. Like one of the things that LIGO searches for is like mountains on neutron stars.
Oh,
If I have a spinning object with a quadrupole moment, then it emits like a quasi-periodic gravity wave train. And it's a very similar type of search where you have some, you know, quasi-periodic thing that's nearly regular until you get to long time scales, and then there's some model, some phase model that you have to loop over.
So this kind of complicated phase fitting is absolutely critical for the black hole pulsar, especially supermassive black hole pulsar binaries. And I know Michel Kramer and company are trying to do that. Do you know how this compares to what they do? I mean, so they just totally, that's slightly an unfair question, but I know they've been producing this sort of technology, but I don't know how they do it.
I don't actually know what they do. So I'd be curious to see that after the
okay.
You can point me. Is it published?
I don't know how much of it's proprietary and how much is published.
Yeah.
But they're absolutely invested in trying to find very close binary pulsars in the galactic center and other, and that means that they are seeing large accelerations.
Oh, cool. Okay.
So all of these problems. I mean, this sounds like a perfect solution to that, right?
Because
you don't care how it evolves.
Oh yeah, right.
Sorry to make another comment. In computer science, there's a problem called parsing, where you have a long string of characters, and you want to find a certain pattern that satisfies certain constraints in there. And there are these similar algorithms where you create a table of something and look at the next character, and then backtrack, and so on. So I wonder whether there's...
I know what you mean. They do sort of remind me. I know the algorithms you mean, they do sort of remind me of each other.
It's also sounds like particle.
So, on the subject of analogies for other things, here's the one that I think is the most fun. I don't know if this is useful, but I think it's fun. This really reminds me of the pathfinding rule in quantum mechanics. So the classical action is a number that I attach to a path x of t, which is a local but nonlinear for a general potential v, a local but nonlinear function. Likewise, this e hat statistic is a local but nonlinear function of the phase model phi of t. When I do the path integral in quantum mechanics, I integrate over a space of paths. And the integrand is e to a constant times s. And this h hat statistic, look, it's the same thing. It's a sum over a space of paths, e to a constant times e hat. This recursion relation that I was talking about looks obscure, but if you think about it, it's the same trick that allows you to derive the Schrodinger equation from the path integral. On an infinitesimal timescale, the path integral is just a differential equation. This h hat statistic, if you're just evolving by one chunk, it looks like a simple recursion relation. So that's fun. It would be really interesting if there was some way to import machinery from physics to think about the pulsar search problem. I'm not sure that that's true. If this were a problem, and if there were more than one time coordinate, then maybe we'd secretly be doing field theory and there would be more machinery to import. But sadly, nature has only provided us with one time coordinate when we look for pulsars. So
if you have high dimensional spaces and want to solve integrals or something, then tensor networks would be useful for that. But you have a chain of long expressions and then you make particular simplifications that you could go down from an exponential search space or something.
Yeah. I mean, there's lots of analogies. This is kind of like a natural idea. There's lots of analogies, other things.
But you also have sky locations, so there's at least two other trivial dimensions.
I think the sky location and the dispersion are things you just have to brute force outer loop over. Because those are just like independent trials. There's no connection between the different sky locations. Mm-hmm. So here's where I got in October. I thought this was looking like super interesting. I mean, there were a few like very interesting algorithms that really seemed to be improving things. Now, what actually happened here is that this big avalanche of work came along for actually like engineering and deploying the Chime FRB backend. And so I sort of had to put this on pause, but I think it's an incredibly interesting problem, and I hope to excavate myself from the avalanche soon and go back to it. The first thing I'd like to do, like sort of a near-term goal, is to look for new pulsars in existing data sets. I think there are actually lots of public data sets where we should be able to find new pulsars. Think about this warm-up case for Chime of a long contiguous time stream is actually the mainstream case that projects like SKA or Meerkat are interested in. So it'd be interesting to talk to other people in the field, see how useful this is. Maybe a public code would be a good idea. And then what I would love to do is to develop ideas further, solve this holy grail problem of making the pulsar search work in Chime, and find big catalogs of many, many new pulsars at Chime. Wouldn't that be cool? But it depends on solving unsolved problems, and that's hard to predict. I'm going to just show a few more slides. In a talk, there's so many things that Chime can do that I just chose to focus on these transients, because that's what I've been working on lately. Most of the time, I'm a cosmologist. And I didn't even mention until now the cosmology we want to do with Chime, which is mapping neutral hydrogen in the universe. The 21 centimeter radiation from neutral hydrogen gets redshifted and shows up at a particular wavelength, which we can use as a radial coordinate to make a map in 3D. So we can make maps of large-scale structure in the universe by intensity mapping the neutral hydrogen that we can do all of the same large-scale structure stuff with that you would try to do with, say, a galaxy survey. In particular, we can try to measure the baryon acoustic oscillation feature in the neutral hydrogen correlation function and constrain the expansion history of the universe. If we can solve some other hard computational problems that would be a subject for a different talk related to foreground removal, then we could get error bars on the expansion history, which are competitive with upcoming dark energy experiments like Euclid or LSST. We'd like to, I'm just kind of do like a slideshow of the different science that we'd like to do with Chime. The pulsar timing is very interesting. We would like to contribute precision timing measurements of interesting millisecond pulsars to global efforts to look for gravity waves. As everyone probably knows, if you're timing all of these pulsars in the galaxy and then a gravity wave comes through, then it systematically advances or delays times of arrival of the pulses with a pattern that's characteristic of a gravity wave, the same way that in LIGO it affects the travel time through the two arms of the interferometer. Let me just conclude with a few thoughts. I think it's very exciting to be part of a project which is such a massive step up in sensitivity, and we can try to improve on so many different things at once. So Chime is kind of a breakthrough if mapping speed per dollar is the metric. And this is mainly due to commodity hardware becoming so inexpensive. I've put our two MVPs on the slide, the graphics processing unit and the 10 gigabit Ethernet card. Thanks, guys. Couldn't do it without you. What's really interesting to think about is the cost of scaling up Chime. So if you imagine increasing the collecting area A of an interferometer, holding fixed the number of antennas per unit area, then the cost of computing has an A squared in it because you're computing a two-point function. But it's also exponentially suppressed because of Moore's law. The cost of building computers is an exponentially decreasing function of time. The cost of all the non-computing stuff, like the antennas, the cylinders, and so on, is all just proportional to 1 power of A. The mapping speed, the product of beams times collecting area, goes as A squared. And that's just a fundamental fact about interferometers. If you put two interferometers next to each other, the mapping speed goes up by factor 4, not 2. So right now, Chime is computation dominated. And if I convert this to cost as a function of forgiven mapping speed, right now we're in this regime where if we were to build Chime, a version of Chime with twice the mapping speed, but we also built it 2 years later, then it would be the same cost. These factors would cancel. So we get to just scale up for free. And after a few Moore's law times, the computers will become cheaper than the antennas. Then it will scale as m to the 1/2. But this is also kind of an amazing scaling. I mean, normally, if you think about scaling up like an optical telescope, the cost is a very high, a high power, definitely not less than 1, of the collecting area. It'll be really amazing. I mean, if Chime is really successful and someone wants to spend 10 times as much money and do a big project, at least in this era, you might get an instrument that was 100 times more powerful. I've heard this slogan before. I don't know who to attribute it to. that radio telescopes are paperclips connected to supercomputers. This is an old quote, and what I think it describes is when it was first possible to do digital radio astronomy properly, when supercomputers became powerful enough. So that's a very interesting era. But we're entering a different era now, where the supercomputers are only a factor of a few more expensive than the paperclips and might be cheaper soon. So that's a very interesting era where the cost of doing an experiment is just the cost of laying out an array of paperclips covering a certain collecting area. And then the computers are almost like an afterthought. I think CHIME is sort of an experiment in this new kind of like massive interferometer design. We're demonstrating a lot of new technology. And I hope that this is the beginning of a very interesting new era that we're establishing the tools for. I think that the impact, what we can and can't do, will largely depend on which algorithms in radio astronomy we can scale up to these new data volumes. We're really thinking hard about these algorithmic questions. Finally, I want to make one sort of higher level point that I didn't put in the slide, but I want to say, especially for students, that if you like both physics and computer science, which I do, as you can probably tell from the talk, really like both, then I think there are lots of sort of critical, unsolved, solvable problems. The problems that I talked about here are just one example. There aren't very many people with both toolkits that are thinking about this type of problem. So if you think you might be interested in this sort of thing, then I'd like to encourage everyone to come talk to me. That's it. Thanks.
First, your commentary, paperclips connected to supercomputers, that is historically accurate. The largest supercomputers historically have always been correlators, which they're all arc sine machines, which make them useless for every other application. But that's an interesting thing. There were teraflop machines in the 70s. One problem faced by interferometry, and especially by VLBI, which of course I spend most of the time thinking about, is fringe searching, which sounds that it, like it's similar in spirit to a lot of these other things that you're doing. And you'll know VLBI typically has very narrow beams because the fringe searching is prohibitively difficult. So you only look at one synthesized beam at a time, but each of your telescopes is a much wider beam. So I was wondering if some of these sorts of algorithmic ideas could be applied in VLBI that would allow people to map the entire beam of the constituent stations instead of the synthesized beam.
That is a super interesting question that I had not thought about. That seems like a great problem to think about. I haven't actually thought about this question, so I have no sense what the answer might be, but that seems like a really great thing to think about.
You said that CHIME is starting actually next summer.
Yeah.
But you made it sound like some of these algorithms are kind of not going to be in place by next summer. Is it? So when it actually starts, are we going to be looking at the ten repeaters a day?
Right. So we are hoping to deploy the FRB search at the same time that the telescope goes online. The pulsar search will not be. That's more in like an algorithms research stage.
Could you say the differences with Hyrax? What's the difference between Hyrax and CHIME?
There's a new project called Hyrax in South Africa that is sort of the same idea as CHIME, to have just a regular array of antennas connected to a massive GPU correlator. One difference is that Hyrax uses arrays of dishes, inexpensive commodity satellite dishes, whereas CHIME uses this custom cylinder design. They have some trade-offs. One really cool thing about the dishes that I'm rather attached to.
Is there only one antenna per dish or many antennas per dish?
There would be one antenna per dish. Okay. But you'd have, like, say, 1,024 dishes. One really cool thing about the dishes is that it becomes very easy to do localization of FRBs by very long baseline interferometry. You can have, a core with many collecting elements and then some outrigger stations with a few dishes. In CHIME, the problem is that you need the beams to match, and so the outriggers have to be telescopes that are at roughly the same size as Chime itself. Whereas with dishes, you would just use a smaller number of dishes. So it's a lot easier.
So it has some advantages.
Yeah, yeah.
Presumably more
for
expensive to build antennas than Chime. Chime must be very cheap.
It is. I'm actually not sure how the cost per unit collecting area compares.
But you're saying it's not obviously much more expensive.
If you were building them from scratch, then Chime would definitely be cheaper. We're sort of leveraging this like enormous industry that exactly. Like mass produced.
But in terms of the mapping speed, it's comparable to Chime?
It should be larger.
By what factor?
So the number of collecting elements should be the same, 1024, but the collecting area is four times bigger. Four times bigger.
What are the data plans for Chime? So the data would be stored, and then take a second look afterwards.
I didn't really talk about that. We have, like, for the FRB search, we do need to store, like, on the order of hundreds of terabytes of data. So we'd have to have a plan for having a bunch of file servers and backups at McGill. But hundreds of terabytes is, like, not actually that big of a deal.
But that's how many days? You said you're going to generate a petabyte per day.
Oh, that's the raw data coming in untriggered. So the purpose of the FRB backend, the minimum that it has to accomplish is trigger to reduce the data volume by, say, a factor of 1,000. It doesn't have to have, it's not a requirement that it have zero false positives. It just has to reduce the data to the size that can be stored on disk and a human can digest later. It's sort of like the LHC, right? They just, at some low level, they have this enormous data stream, and then they need to trigger and decide to save.
Yeah, so what percentage of the data can you store?
I think like 1/1,000th would not be a problem. That would, if you went from a petabyte a day to a terabyte a day, I think that would be okay. 1% is pushing it.
So the difference with LHC is you want to look at correlations. They don't care about correlations.
The data rate. So I thought that you were. Now, I was talking about, when I said a petabyte a day, I was talking about the data rate here. The data rate here is much larger. Here, we can only ever save like a really negligible fraction. I mean, this is on the order of a terabyte per second.
Well, the question that I was thinking was, what would you do if you tried to look for the price? You're going to get some guidance perhaps from some other detection through observation and try to go on and dig the data.
Yeah, right.
Don't worry so much you're losing by not.
I think a good historical example is the discovery of FRBs themselves, which were in data that had been archived on disk for many years. Just no one noticed because everyone thought they had a complete list of things to look for, or they're just being searched by computer. It's hard to have a good general answer to that question. It's true that when you have data streams of this size, and you're the rare events, and you're triggering to reduce the data, rare events that are not in your triggers, you'll probably never see.
So your pulsar search, you haven't run it on Mark data, have you?
I do my own like toy simulations. If that's what you mean.
That's what I'm asking.
Yeah.
So you do find the offer that
you did. Oh, yeah. I do like Monte Carlo simulation.
So what happens if you increase the observing frequency? Is it true that the profitability goes down because you're collecting more data that you have to correlate? Or could the same technology in principle be applied to 1,000 times higher frequency?
Oh, yeah. The computational cost is proportional to the bandwidth.
Yeah.
So if by scaling up the frequency, you mean leaving, say, the fractional bandwidth the same so that the bandwidth goes up too, then it does become a lot more expensive. Like, that's the issue for EHT, right? That the correlation is so
large bandwidth?
Yeah.
I was curious about that as well, because you present this wonderful scheme for finding
fast radio bursts, which is really just an issue of de-dispersing instantaneous signals. But then when you talk about trying to find pulsars, you said, well, we're just going to put this in a big loop. Are you using the same algorithm to de-disperse the pulses?
I think it makes sense to do that. Although, for me, it's more convenience than wanting a practical speed up, because the pulsar search is so much more expensive than the dedispersion. It would be OK if you used the slower algorithm. But because it's like, I know it's optimal, and also it's my code, so I know how to use it. It's easier for me to use my own dedispersion code.
Okay,
great.